Fugitive never had any intentions of leaving Portsmouth. Two could play at subterfuge. If Judge Ever wavered in her conviction, the small black community of Portsmouth made it their priority to buttress her resolve. Once her friends caught wind of the concocted compromise, they worked in earnest to convince her to remain in Portsmouth. Judge was dissuaded from returning, and the vessel sailed without her. The bondwoman avoided the empty promises of Washington's associate, who'd been tasked with the uncomfortable business of hunting fugitives. Whipple was left empty-handed. Even though the fugitive had misled Whipple, he wasn't angry with her. He knew that his failed attempt at slave-catching would prove thorny with the president, but he couldn't blame Judge for her response. How could anyone want to return to a life of slavery? Instead of worrying about Judge, he turned his attention to the next task at hand, informing Secretary Wolcott that he was unsuccessful at apprehending the runaway. As he sat down to pen the difficult letter, he understood the need for diplomacy. Whipple needed to demonstrate that his attempt at capturing Ona Judge simply fell short, and under no circumstances let on that he wasn't unhappy about his failure. His tone was apologetic, explaining that he had found Judge, investigated the situation, and had uncovered several important details. He wrote, "After a cautious examination, it appeared to me that she had not been decoyed away, as had been apprehended, but that a thirst for complete freedom, which she was informed would take place on her arrival here or Boston, had been her only motive for absconding." The customs collector knew that this information, as well as the rest of his letter, would trouble Wolcott and the president, so he tried to disengage the bomb that he knew was about to explode. He spoke well of Ona Judge and made note of how respectful she was of the First Family. According to Whipple, Judge was kind with her words and affectionate toward the president and his wife. She expressed great affection and reverence for her master and mistress, and without hesitation declared her willingness to return and to serve with fidelity during the lives of the president and his lady, if she could be freed on their decease, should she outlive them. The only way Whipple could see Ona Judge returning was if she were eventually set free, and he went so far as to negotiate on her behalf. Audaciously, Whipple told Wolcott, and thus the president, that gradual emancipation was the best route to follow. The customs collector dared to tell the first president of the United States that he should consider abandoning slavery and that he should begin with Ona Judge. Whipple may have suspected what was sure to follow the receipt of his letter, an escalated attempt to reclaim the fugitive, which he thought was a pointless task, though he didn't say so in such direct terms. Instead, he reminded Wolcott of the changing attitudes in New Hampshire, attitudes that were no longer congruent with the institution of slavery. Not only were whites in New Hampshire unlikely to support the covert actions of the president, but blacks would also do their best to shield fugitives from a return to slavery. Whipple wrote, "I am informed that many slaves from the southern states have come to Massachusetts and some to New Hampshire, either of which states they consider as an asylum. The popular opinion here in favor of universal freedom has rendered it difficult to get them back to their masters." Careful not to explicitly state his own feelings about slavery, Whipple pointed the secretary in a new direction, one that would take this matter out of the hands of the customs collector and place it in the control of different authorities. Whipple told Wolcott that Ona Judge was immovable and would not be convinced to return of her own free will. Given the circumstances, the customs collector felt it best for the president to hire a lawyer and that all future inquiries should come from an officer of the president's household to the attorney of the United States in New Hampshire. Whipple wanted out. He knew that the situation was a hornet's nest, and once it became clear that Ona Judge could not be whisked away in the middle of the night, he backed away from the messy business of slave catching. Whipple concluded his letter, ending his direct involvement with the messy affair. He wrote, "It is with regret that I give up the prospect of executing the business in the favorable manner that I at first flattered myself it would be done." If Washington wanted his slave woman back, he would have to follow the law and consequently expose himself to the growing anti-slavery sentiment in New Hampshire and across New England. Oliver Wolcott informed the president of Whipple's botched attempt at reclaiming the runaway slave. In a moment of anger and frustration, Washington released Wolcott from his slave-catching duties and on November 28, 1796, wrote directly to Joseph Whipple. He addressed Whipple's suggestions about emancipation, stating, "To enter into such a compromise with her is totally inadmissible." The president was offended by the simple thought of negotiating with one of his slaves. He found Judge's conduct reprehensible and refused to reward bad behavior with the promise of freedom. Perhaps in an attempt to massage the moral beliefs of Whipple, Washington went on to hint at his own misgivings about slavery, stating, "For however well disposed I might be to gradual abolition, or even to an entire emancipation of that description of people, if the latter was in itself practicable at this moment, it would neither be politic or just to reward unfaithfulness with a premature preference." The president's attitudes regarding African slavery did soften during the latter years of his life. By the 1780s, years before Judge ran away, he discussed his growing unease with lifelong enslavement with close friends such as Tobias Lear and the French military officer and revolutionary comrade, the Marquis de Lafayette. But Washington was not willing to entertain a life without bound labor, and was certainly unwilling to offer Judge anything but a return voyage home to Virginia. The president explained that he would offer fairness to his runaway. However, he could do no more, as her actions were impudent and unacceptable. Although Washington leveled subtle accusations of mishandling the situation, he refused to allow the customs collector to back out of his assignment. That was simply not a choice that the president was willing to offer to his appointed official. He directed Whipple to assure the fugitive that she would not be punished for her momentary lack of good judgment. The president wrote that Judge will be forgiven by her mistress, and she will meet with the same treatment from me that all the rest of her family, which is a very numerous one, shall receive. This apparent olive branch to Judge was in actuality a thinly veiled threat. Fugitive slaves knew all too well about the risk of reprisals that often affected family members, and the casual mention of Judge's family served as a reminder to Judge that the punishment for her escape could land squarely on the shoulders of her immediate family. This was the only way in which the president would negotiate with his slave woman. He demanded that Judge come back into his possession or face the knowledge that her actions could cause pain and suffering for her family members. If Judge decided not to return voluntarily, Whipple was instructed to place the bondwoman on a vessel bound for Alexandria or the Federal City, directly back into the jaws of slavery. Washington made it clear that he did not want Whipple to use extreme force with Judge, for he knew that this could cause a public disturbance or would excite a mob or riot, something that Washington did not want to confront during the last few months of his presidency. The president reminded Whipple to use discretion and not to show his cards as he had on his first encounter with the fugitive. As a Revolutionary War hero, Washington understood the importance of strategy, and he knew surprise was sometimes the best weapon in battle. The act of capture would only work with discretion, and if done properly, Judge could be returned home with relative speed, something that the president wished for the benefit of Mrs. Washington, who was desirous of receiving her again. Yet it was the last few sentences in Washington's letter that revealed another motive for the speedy return of his property. "We had vastly rather she would be sent to Virginia than brought to this place, Philadelphia, as our stay here will be but short, and it is not unlikely that she may, from the circumstances I have mentioned, be in a state of pregnancy." So now the president believed that Ona Judge was pregnant. If this was true, the first family's property had increased, and the president was now hunting Ona Judge and her unborn child. Almost an entire month passed before Whipple returned Washington's letter. The customs collector may have been unusually busy, but it's more likely he was at a loss for words and worried about the repercussions of failing to collect and retrieve the president's slave. It wasn't until December 22nd that Whipple sat down to write to the president. With only 3 months left to Washington's term in office, Whipple was careful in his tone, apologizing to the First Lady for his inability to apprehend Judge. "I sincerely lament the ill success of my endeavors to restore to your lady her servant on the request of Mr. Wolcott. It had indeed become a subject of anxiety to me on an idea that her services were very valuable to her mistress and not readily to be replaced." Whipple responded to some of the claims leveled by the president in his last correspondence, making certain Washington understood that he was not at fault. If anything, Whipple was insulted that the president didn't understand the extent to which he had even tried to protect Washington's reputation among the men and women of New Hampshire. In his estimation, he had worked in the best interests of the president. Still, no appointed official wanted to raise the ire of the president, so Whipple half-heartedly agreed to do all that was possible to continue with the plans of returning Judge. He made it clear that he would continue to pursue her as long as there was no public cry of outrage. Whipple made no promises, stating that he would need to decide for himself if the conditions were suitable for the return of a fugitive. Whipple ended his letter with a promise to help in whatever way possible, but not before offering a piece of political advice. Although the president was on his way out of office, Whipple, for the moment, had the president's ear and suggested that gradual emancipation would be the only way to stem the tide of fugitives who would cause disruption for white northerners, southern slaveholders, and for the runaways themselves. Slave owners, such as the president, could prevent this growing evil and menace of fugitive slaves. All they had to do was let go of human bondage. Perhaps Whipple was compelled by his own feelings and concerns regarding slavery, but more likely, his inability and unwillingness to serve the president was linked to his changing political allegiance. Both he and his friend John Langdon had shifted away from the Federalist Party, prompting Whipple to feel no real obligation to serve the outgoing president. While he never articulated a personal reservation about the moral bankruptcy of the institution of slavery, Whipple expressed support for gradual abolition, a strategy that would honor the financial investments of slaveholders and that would allow for emancipated men and women to remain in their own states. A prolonged ending of slavery might reverse the trend of fugitives heading north, disentangling the residents of New Hampshire and all of New England from the knot of southern slavery. Whipple's letter made one thing clear. Washington could not depend on the help of appointed or elected officers in New Hampshire to get Judge back to Virginia. The president never wrote back to Whipple about Ona Judge, excepting that his influence over the customs collector was far less than he had anticipated. He realized that he wouldn't be able to recapture the fugitive, at least not immediately. Martha Washington would need to be patient and select a different slave to serve their newly married granddaughter, a task that shouldn't prove difficult given the hundreds of available slaves at Mount Vernon. Instead, Washington would turn his attention to the transfer of power to John Adams, his Massachusetts-born vice president, who had just weeks before narrowly won the first contested American presidential election. Washington needed to focus on a seamless administrative transition and a permanent relocation back to his beloved Mount Vernon. Tracking down a fugitive slave would not make its way onto the president's list of priorities. Ona Judge was safe, for now. 12. Mrs. Staines. 3 days after Whipple penned his December letter to the president, Judge celebrated her first Christmas away from the Washingtons. Her meager wages would not have allowed Judge to purchase gifts for her new friends in Portsmouth, but she may have presented them with nuts or a small amount of chocolate, token offers of appreciation for all that they had done for her. The year that had passed had been dizzying, and while she was grateful for the freedom that she had stolen from the Washingtons, her joy would always be tempered. Her loved ones remained enslaved back at Mount Vernon, and the guilt of her successful escape must have weighed constantly on her heart. Most fugitives coaxed their minds into temporary amnesia, creating an emotional distance from the memory of their pasts. Judge pushed her pain and sadness deep into the recesses of her soul. It would be the only way for her to move forward with a new life. And move forward she did. News of the single young woman would have spread quickly through the small black community, and eligible bachelors would have taken notice of the newcomer, even with her complicated fugitive status. It was Jack Staines who caught her attention. Judge was a quick study and soon understood that she needed to find a husband. In 18th century America, a woman, white or black, needed a spouse for protection and survival. Independent living was no easy task for Judge, and although she was able to pick up low-paying domestic work, black women knew that two incomes were almost always necessary. Although free black men were constantly disrespected and trapped in the web of racial discrimination, they carried some power in their male bodies, power that would allow Ona Judge to have a chance for security and maybe even prosperity. Eliza Custis Law would not be the only one to select a husband and marry quickly. Ona Judge and Jack Staines would celebrate the Christmas of 1796 together, completely aware that the president might try to reclaim Judge at any moment. And by January of 1797, the two chose to marry one another. For Judge, this was another example of freedom's possibilities. Before the romantic notions of marriage became the established norm, men and women across the new nation married for reasons other than love, more specifically for survival. Male farmers married young women with modest dowries and the physical capabilities to complete the hard domestic duties and fieldwork that often accompanied life on a small farm. Aside from a dowry, a woman could bring many things to a marriage, but children were the most valued prizes of all. Ensuring that the family name would live on, children, male children in particular, offered small farmers an important nuclear family during an age in which subsistence farming was still the modus operandi for many. Children would grow into strong young men and women, capable of assisting fathers and mothers in the fields, the house, and the blacksmithing shops across the country. Judge, of course, had no dowry to offer, but she was young and healthy. It was almost impossible to make a life for oneself without a family network, and Judge found a remedy to the ailment of poverty and isolation in a free black man. Whether it was a marriage of convenience or a true love affair that brought the two together, Ona Judge would begin the new year with a legal marriage to a free black man that she chose. The institution of slavery prohibited the legal marriages of enslaved men and women, and had Judge remained under the ownership of the Washington Custis family, she may never have experienced the autonomy that came along with the selection of a spouse. Like many other free black men who lived along the Northeast seaboard, Jack Staines spent long periods of time working at sea. Black men who followed this employment path were known as blackjacks, and although seafaring was viewed as an unstable and unseemly occupation for whites, it offered opportunity to black men incapable of finding decent wages elsewhere. While out at sea, blackjacks suffered racial discrimination from their crew and sea captains. But the open seas offered protection from corrupt slave catchers and kidnappers who lurked in the streets and alleys of northern cities. Barred from jobs of distinction or respectability, black sailors were often catapulted into positions of honor in early free black communities. More, the lump sum payouts, which were on par with what white men received, that Jack Staines and other black seafaring men received at the end of their journeys, were often applied to the purchase of land or a home, an unreachable goal for most black men at the turn of the 19th century. Of course, there were risks. Journeys to the South or to the Caribbean were dangerous. By the beginning decades of the 19th century, some southern states imprisoned free black sailors. South Carolina's 1822 Negro Seamen Act followed the foiled slave insurrection plotted by Denmark Vesey, a former slave and sailor. Free men such as Staines, who sailed into the Charleston port of call, were imprisoned during their stay, and the captains of vessels who used free black crew members were forced to pay for the prison lodging of their sailors until they departed. On longer voyages to places such as Jamaica and Barbados, free black sailors not only encountered the expected dangers of pirating, shipwrecks, and illness, but they also faced the fear of unlawful enslavement. Who would come to the rescue of Jack Staines if he were imprisoned and sold into Caribbean slavery? Although the risks were great and the pay was minimal, black sailors gambled with their lives to provide for themselves and their families. Marriage would not free Judge from hard domestic labor. She would have to work, too. Judge was in the same position as many other married free black women of the era. Her income was necessary. Whatever meager earnings she could collect from domestic work, laundering, or sewing would help the family survive between the long periods of time that spanned Jack Staines' paydays. Ona Judge knew that being married to a black sailor would be filled with opportunities. In Staines, she found a husband who was employable and who could provide for her and whatever children they might have. Yet she knew that marriage to a sailor would also mean a life of long absences and weeks of solitude. Judge would spend many months waiting for Jack Staines' ship to appear in port, and while she waited, she would be left alone to fend off any would-be slave catchers. News of the Staines' marriage engagement traveled around Portsmouth, even finding its way to the information-hungry Whipple, who had reluctantly agreed to continue to help Washington. He learned that Jack Staines and Ona Judge celebrated the Christmas season by carefully planning their impending matrimony. The couple visited the county clerk in Portsmouth and applied for a marriage certificate, careful to follow the law and make certain that their marriage was legally recognized by the state. The document that certified the union between Jack Staines and Ona Judge was not only a symbol of choice, but also one that was legally binding. If something happened to Jack during one of his long voyages out at sea, Judge would be the legal beneficiary of any owed wages or land that had been purchased by her husband. legal proof of marriage was not simply a luxury for the fugitive. It was another form of protection. Once Whipple caught wind of the couple's application for a marriage certificate, he felt compelled to communicate with Portsmouth's clerk. Although he was uncomfortable with his involvement in Washington slave-catching, Whipple confided in the clerk, probably telling him about the bride-to-be, her powerful owners, and their deep desire to reclaim their property. Whatever words were shared between the clerk and the customs collector resulted in delayed paperwork, and the couple would soon learn that claiming a marriage certificate in Portsmouth would be next to impossible. This roadblock was disappointing to the young couple, but Jack Staines and Ona Judge would not give up on their dream of a legal marriage. They simply couldn't. The two must have spoken with friends, collected advice, and planned their next strategic move, deciding to bypass the clerk in Portsmouth altogether. Staines and Judge traveled to nearby Greenland, a few miles outside the city, where County Clerk Thomas Philbrook provided the couple with the required documents. On the very same page of the New Hampshire Gazette that reported George Washington's words of appreciation to the nation, the newlyweds announced their marriage to the New Hampshire community. The small section of the paper that announced recent marriages listed only two couples on January 14, 1797. Attorney Thomas Thompson announced his nuptials to Miss Eliza Porter in Haverhill, New Hampshire, and listed directly below them was the fugitive and her new free husband. A simple 10 words publicly announced their union. In this town, Mr. John Staines to Miss Oney Judge. Sick. Samuel Haven, Reverend of Portsmouth South Church, married them. With no extra money to purchase a new wedding dress, Judge would have selected to wear something from her existing wardrobe. For months, the fugitive dressed inconspicuously, wearing plain clothing appropriate for a domestic. But on her wedding day, she would have pulled out one of her nicer dresses, one that she used to wear while serving the Washingtons. Many women placed small flowers in their hair to mark the special occasion, but January's heavy snow left Ona Judge with no such embellishments. Perhaps she attached a few scraps of lace to her wedding attire, but a veil would have been too costly and impractical. Jack Staines probably dressed in a tailcoat and his nicest pair of trousers, typical pants for sailors and working men, instead of costly knee-length silk breeches. There would be no expensive wedding bands or elaborate celebratory meals, but instead the newlyweds probably shared a simple dinner of fish or oyster stew, brown bread, and maybe a bit of Indian pudding for dessert. The couple spent their first year together settling in, securing work, and trying to forge ahead. As was custom, Ona Judge adopted her husband's last name, becoming Ona Staines, and continued to acclimate to her new life. With her husband's sailing income and her wages from domestic work, the two were able to move into their own home. The census listed Jack Staines, who also used the first name John, as the head of the household, along with 3 other people in the Staines home. No slaves were recorded in their dwelling, a reminder that the fugitive Mrs. Staines passed as a free woman. Early census records offered much more detail for white families, such as the gender and age of all household occupants. Records concerning people of color were far less descriptive, simply noting the free status of an individual and the number of people who belonged to a specific household. Many black women who served as domestics lived with their employers, but Staines did not fall into this category. Not only did she live in a separate space from her employer, she lived with her husband and 2 other people. One of these roommates might have been someone in need, a boarder who couldn't afford to live alone, who appealed to the young black family for help. It was likely that this person could share in a few household expenses, easing the financial responsibilities that continued to grow in the Staines household. Plus, A boarder provided her the opportunity to give back. A family had taken her in during her time of need. Now it was her turn to reciprocate. Extra money was always welcome, especially once Ona Staines told her husband the exciting news. She was expecting a child. Her pregnancy would cement the young couple's relationship, reminding Jack and Ona Staines that they had more than themselves to think about. She continued with her domestic work, though that became more difficult as the months elapsed and her belly swelled. Scrubbing floors and lifting heavy containers of water became almost impossible as she approached the end of her pregnancy. But she did not have the luxury of unemployment. An aching back and swollen feet were symptoms that simply couldn't interfere with the collection of wages, so Ona Staines most likely relied upon home remedies to ease her discomfort. A vinegar and rose water solution was believed to reduce the inflammation of feet and ankles, and swathing bands were tied around the bottom of the abdomen and the back of the neck to offer back support. She grew up watching enslaved women in Virginia remain in the fields up until the delivery of their babies. These women returned to their work assignments shortly after giving birth, never giving their bodies time to heal from the trauma of birth. She'd have to do the same. When the time came, Ona Staines would have relied upon her small circle of friends for help with delivering her baby. Labor was usually long and dangerous, often taking the lives of both mother and child. Perhaps she had saved enough money to pay for a midwife, someone who would guide Mrs. Staines through delivery, as friends and neighbors supported her on a birthing stool. Although we do not know that exact date, sometime in 1798, Ona Staines delivered a healthy baby girl. They would name her Eliza. The birth of this child served as another marker of freedom. Ona Staines reared Eliza according to her own will, and with the help of her husband, the young family directed its own future. Yet Staines had to temper her happiness with a realistic fear. She could never lay her worries about capture to bed. Every day and every night, Staines knew that her world could be turned upside down by a forced return to her legal master. Now the stakes were higher. She had to think about her baby daughter Eliza as well. Staines had passed the disease of slavery to her daughter. Even though she was born in Portsmouth, Eliza was the legal property of the Custis estate. Jack Staines's status as a free man made no difference when it came to the condition of his daughter. Some 500 miles away, the Washingtons were becoming reacquainted with their beloved Mount Vernon. John Adams became the second president to lead the nation, and George Washington retired to a life as a private citizen. And Martha Washington made her final return home in May of 1797. She was elated to leave public life and to reconnect with her family. The past 15 months had been nothing short of a whirlwind, a period that began with the news of the impetuous engagement and marriage of Eliza Park Custis, and was followed by her bondwoman's escape. After the excitement of the presidential election, the Washingtons prepared for additional life-changing news. Now married, granddaughter Elizabeth Park Custis Law prepared to give birth to her first child, the first Custis Washington great-grandchild who would survive childhood. On January 19, 1797, little Eliza was born, marking a new era in the Washington family. Thomas and Elizabeth Law's fast and furious nuptials were now strengthened by the birth of a child. Coincidentally, both Ona Staines and Elizabeth Custis Law began their lives as newly married women with daughters named Eliza. For the first few years of the Staines' life in New Hampshire, the young family found a way to survive and to avoid money-hungry slave catchers. But the president's interest in reclaiming Staines reemerged with a vengeance in a relatively short time. By July of 1799, Washington had occupied the space of private citizen for a little more than 2 years and decided that it was time to pursue his runaway property again. During a visit with Martha Washington's nephew, Burwell Bassett Jr., the president rekindled the search for Staines, this time relying upon his nephew to handle this very personal and discreet piece of family business. In the president's mind, Burwell Bassett Jr. was the perfect person to negotiate the return of the family's slave woman. As a member of the Virginia Senate, Bassett Jr. could travel to New Hampshire on business and, while there, find an opportunity to interact with Senator John Langdon, the former ally and friend of the president. As the final preparations for the trip were made, the president gave Bassett a letter in which he made clear that Martha Washington was still in need of her body servant, and he offered his nephew additional details about Staines's escape. Not that he used or ever would use her married name. 3 years later, and despite Whipple's report to the contrary, the president still maintained that Mrs. Staines had been enticed away by a Frenchman, and that she had considered returning to the Washingtons, but decided to remain in New Hampshire when her demand for freedom was denied. Washington's views had not changed. Under no circumstances would he allow Mrs. Staines to negotiate for her own freedom, stating that it would set an impolitic and dangerous precedent. Burwell Bassett set out for New Hampshire, where he lodged with Senator John Langdon, the father of Elizabeth Langdon, the first person to notify the Washingtons of their fugitive's presence in New Hampshire. While Langdon did not count himself among the early anti-slavery agitators, he had shifted his position regarding many issues since the beginning of his relationship with the president. Although he began his career in politics in the New Republic, his political beliefs and alliances had changed by the time Washington left office. No longer a staunch Federalist, Langdon switched parties, and during the Adams presidency, he labeled himself a Democratic Republican. Even though the Langdon family had a long history of slave ownership, the senator expressed reservations about the inclusion of slavery in the United States Constitution, and suggested that the transatlantic slave trade be abolished earlier than 1808. Slaves who were previously owned by the Langdon family were emancipated and rehired as paid laborers, yet Senator Langdon did not refer to himself as an abolitionist. Burwell Bassett Jr., therefore, assumed that he could rely upon the senator for help and advice during his travels to Portsmouth. By all accounts, his trip should have been a quick one. After all, he already knew where she lived. There would be no time wasted searching for the runaway. Now 25 years old, Ona Staines heard a knock at the door and unknowingly opened her home to her worst nightmare. Standing in front of her was a familiar face from the past, one that she had never wanted to see again. She must have felt the blood drain from her head and neck as familiar stomach-turning fear temporarily stopped her in her tracks. Baby Eliza, now about 1 year old, would have been close by, probably teetering around the Staines home with unsteady legs and an unrelenting curiosity to touch anything within sight. She would have looked at Bassett without fear, for she had no idea just how dangerous this smooth-talking visitor really was. A mother's instinct would have prompted Mrs. Staines to scoop her baby up into her arms, holding Eliza tight as she faced Washington's nephew for what would be the battle of her life. She couldn't run and hide. Staines had to confront the slave catcher. How she wished she hadn't answered the door. The timing couldn't have been worse, as Bassett's visit coincided with one of Jack Staines's lengthy voyages at sea, leaving the fugitive to take care of herself and their small child. Her husband's absences were always difficult, but the appearance of Washington's slave catcher reminded Mrs. Staines that she would always have to rely upon her own abilities and the resourcefulness and kindness of friends to elude her owner's grasp. Bassett followed the advice offered to him before leaving Mount Vernon. That is, he tried to convince the fugitive that she would face no retaliation if she voluntarily returned to Virginia. He was not abusive or rough in his tone, a tactic used to show the runaway that she could return to Virginia with little reason to worry. But Mrs. Staines knew that the Washington family slave catcher offered nothing but falsehoods and that his words were empty promises. Even if Bassett spoke the truth, Mrs. Staines had no intentions of marching her baby into the death trap of slavery while leaving her husband behind in Portsmouth. Staines told Bassett she would not go with him. She simply refused. As a Virginian, it must have been abnormal, if not offensive, for Bassett to have to negotiate with the slave. Yet it became apparent that the fugitive would not cower. Bassett sweetened the deal, promising that the Washingtons would set her free when she arrived at Mount Vernon. But Mrs. Staines saw right through the slave catcher's threadbare lies as he continued with saccharine sweet language and promises for a gentle return to Virginia. Perhaps he tugged on her heartstrings, reminding Staines of the family that she had left behind at Mount Vernon. Or maybe he described a devastated Martha Washington, who simply couldn't find another person to take the fugitive's place. But as Bassett prattled on, the fugitive found her resolve. Ona Staines looked the president's nephew in the eyes. Righteous indignation and a belief in her right to be free prompted her final and fierce response to Bassett, telling him, "I am free now and choose to remain so." According to federal law, Staines was not free and could be captured and returned to her owner. But Bassett knew that he had to tread lightly in a region where slavery was being reconsidered. The president had most likely warned his nephew of the difficulties he encountered when he tried to reclaim the fugitive 3 years prior. The Washington family must have felt as though the 3 years that had passed had diminished the chances of a public scandal, or that Mrs. Staines would be in such dire straits that she would want to return of her own volition. In very little time, however, Bassett Jr. realized that Mrs. Staines's removal would be more difficult, not less. 3 years of independent living had prepared her for the battle of her life. Stunned by her refusal, Bassett walked away from the Staines's home, having failed to complete the familial obligation of returning Mrs. Washington's body servant. He understood that Northern sentiment was different, but his Southern sensibilities were stoked by the fugitive's stubbornness. Black slaves might be able to speak disrespectfully to white men in New Hampshire, but in Virginia, this simply didn't happen. At least, not without swift correction. Bassett's display of Southern gentility began to evaporate. Kind words and offers of freedom in Virginia had failed miserably, so he would need to regroup, contact his uncle, and wait for further instruction. When Bassett returned to the Langdon home after his unsuccessful attempt to claim Staines, he made clear to his host that he would not leave the fugitive in Portsmouth and that he would take her by force if necessary. The senator was in a difficult position. As an elected official, Langdon was to follow the laws of the land, and that included the returning of fugitives across state lines. But this was a delicate situation, one that required the senator to walk the line between federal law and the sensibilities of the state citizens. Langdon listened to the Virginian's plans, and this sensitive information was relayed to Mrs. Staines. Perhaps the senator sent word to the fugitive, but it is more likely that one of the free black domestics working within the walls of the Langdon home sent along this crucial warning. The young fugitive was told that her life was in danger. Something seemed amiss to the president's nephew once he finally returned to the Staines home. He had come for the fugitive, and this time there would be no considerate persuasion. If necessary, he would take her by force. Perhaps Bassett notified a few discreet friends, men who could help contain the fugitive and her child if she resisted. He might need to tie her arms and legs and forcibly place her in the back of a wagon, a scene that he hoped to avoid, but was willing to entertain if necessary. It's almost certain that a ship was stationed in port and ready to sail directly to Alexandria, Virginia. All he needed to do was apprehend the fugitive. He knocked at the door, probably politely at first, and then more angrily, eventually forcing his way into the home. What he found was a lived-in residence that was empty of its occupants. Perhaps he frantically asked neighbors and townspeople if they had seen the fugitive, or maybe he put together a small search team. Whatever his response, it was too late. The Washington slave woman had disappeared. Yet the fugitive outmaneuvered the president and his agents yet again. When she learned of Bassett's plans to forcibly return her to Virginia, Ona Staines collected her baby girl, hired a stable boy to commandeer a horse and carriage, and made haste for Greenland, the town 8 miles away from Portsmouth that had issued her marriage papers after Portsmouth officials had refused to do so. The carriage moved as quickly as possible, transporting Ona and Eliza Staines to the care of a free black family, the Jacks, who willingly agreed to harbor the fugitives. Bassett returned to Virginia in October of 1799 and had to deliver the unfortunate news to his aunt and uncle. He had been unsuccessful in capturing their human property. Bassett must have also informed the Washingtons that several of their beliefs about the runaway were unfounded. They now knew that their slave woman was not in the possession of a Frenchman, but that she was married with a new baby. If they found that surprising, they would have been shocked to learn that the fugitive was neither destitute, nor was she willing to return to her former owners. She considered herself a free woman, and although the laws of the nation stated otherwise, she moved about her life as though her status had never been that of a slave. Staines's evasion of Bassett must have angered the Washingtons, but it also reminded them of several important facts. Now that George Washington was no longer the president, they could not count upon the assistance of past friends and allies. Even close friends such as Senator Langdon could no longer be considered helpful in an attempt to capture Ona Staines. The former president and his wife would have to devise a new plan. They simply needed a bit of time to figure out the details. 13. The Survivor. On December 12, 1799, the president took what was a routine horseback ride across the farms of Mount Vernon. Washington was extremely involved in the managing of farm activities, and he spent much of the day in the outdoors, suffering through the changing weather that brought snow, hail, and rain. Returning home close to the dinner hour, Washington neglected to change out of his wet riding clothes. He was always a punctual man, so he chose to stay dressed in his damp clothing throughout dinner, rather than take the time to get more comfortable as snow continued to accumulate through the night. The president complained of a sore throat, which grew worse, eventually causing swelling around his vocal cords and a raspy voice. As the evening drew on, his throat became so inflamed that he was unable to finish his evening ritual of newspaper reading with Secretary Tobias Lear. His beloved wife had to ask Lear to complete the reading on her husband's behalf before he retired to bed. The president failed to sleep much, as the discomfort from his throat awakened him in the early hours of the morning. Although Martha Washington wished to send for assistance, the president refused and instead waited until their house slave Caroline appeared to light the fireplace at daybreak before he solicited help. they sent for Tobias Lear, who discovered Washington extremely ill, struggling to breathe, and in desperate need of medical attention. Trusted friend and overseer George Rawlins arrived at the president's bed and bled him before Dr. James Craik, a physician and longtime friend, was sent for from Alexandria. As they waited for the arrival of the doctor, family members and staff attempted to alleviate Washington's suffering. A concoction of molasses, butter, and vinegar was given to the president to soothe his throat, but the thick mixture was almost impossible for Washington to swallow. Home remedies worsened his state, throwing him into convulsions and near suffocation. When Dr. Craik arrived, he bled Washington a second time and ordered a mixture of vinegar and sage tea to be administered for gargling. Dr. Craik must have sensed urgency in the president's condition, for he sent for at least two additional physicians to assist him. A series of uncomfortable therapies was used on the president, from enemas to emetics to induce vomiting. Washington was bled one final time before everyone in his presence acknowledged that the situation was grave. He called for his wife Martha to come to his bedside and to bring with her two wills that were housed in his study. Washington reviewed his wills and selected the document that would define his final wishes. The president directed his wife to burn the second version of his will, and then he called for Tobias Lear. Still able to speak, Washington told his faithful secretary, "I find I am going. My breath cannot last long. I believed from the first that the disorder would prove fatal. Do you arrange and record all my late military letters and papers, arrange my accounts and settle my books, as you know more about them than anyone else, and let Mr. Rawlins finish recording my other letters which he has begun." Late in the evening on December 14, 1799, George Washington took his last breath. Surrounding him were Martha Washington, his friends and doctors, and four slaves. The major life events of white slave owners always directly impacted their slaves. Often, the death of an owner meant the sale or transfer of bondmen and bondwomen, an act that broke apart families. But with the death of George Washington, 123 slaves who lived and toiled at Mount Vernon learned that Washington's final will would eventually emancipate them from bondage, an indication that the president had indeed struggled with the concept of slavery. His will produced a most welcomed surprise for the slaves who belonged to the Washington estate. The president had once considered the immediate emancipation of his slaves upon his demise, but later reversed his thinking. He offered several reasons why this could not happen, but he focused on the trauma that would be inflicted upon slave families at Mount Vernon. To Washington, freedom would break apart families, as more than half of the slaves on his estate were the legal property of the heirs of Daniel Park Custis, Martha Washington's first husband. Many of the slaves on the Mount Vernon farms had intermarried and, according to the president, the immediate release of his slaves would cause disagreeable consequences among slave families. In essence, Washington's slaves would be forced to leave Mount Vernon once they were set free, leaving behind wives, husbands, and children who were owned by the Custis estate and still trapped in lifelong enslavement. The president stipulated in his will that aged slaves, those who were unable to work or support themselves, receive assistance, and that they be comfortably clothed and fed by the Washington heirs after their liberation took effect. Washington also mandated that younger slaves, whose parents were deceased, be bound out as servants until the age of 25. During their servitude, they were to be taught to read and write, and to be brought up to some useful occupation. The only slave immediately emancipated in Washington's will was the president's faithful valet. Poor health and physical disabilities had removed William Lee from the position as a valued house slave. but a close, lengthy relationship with his owner resulted in his freedom. Washington fixated on the difficulties that could come along with immediate freedom, especially for aged slaves who were disabled or the very young. The president gave William Lee the option of remaining enslaved at Mount Vernon to relieve Lee of the responsibilities of independence. Washington made certain that Lee would make this important decision on his own, and that in either situation, his trusted valet would have some kind of security. He offered Lee compensation, noting, "I will allow him an annuity of $30 during his natural life, which shall be independent of the victuals and clothes he has been accustomed to receive." In explaining why William Lee received something that no other slave at Mount Vernon was afforded, Washington wrote, "And this I give him as a testimony of my sense of his attachment to me and for his faithful services during the Revolutionary War." Lee chose to remain at Mount Vernon and receive his annuity on a quarterly basis, but his debilitating knee pain drove him to drink excessively. William Lee died in the winter of 1810 and was laid to rest in the slave burial ground at Mount Vernon. The eventual release of the rest of the president's slaves depended upon one thing, the life of his dear wife, Martha. Washington's bond men and bond women were to be released only upon the death of their mistress, a clear indication of Washington's desire to care for his wife even after his death. Yet the pending emancipation of Washington's slaves made Martha Washington uneasy. The grieving widow knew that the only thing standing in the way of the freedom of more than 100 people was her life. In conversations with relatives and friends, Mrs. Washington commented upon her uneasiness, stating that she was unhappy by the talk in the quarters of the good time coming to the ones to be freed as soon as she died. The former First Lady confided in her friend Abigail Adams, who wrote, "She did not feel as though her life was safe in their hands, for she feared that the enslaved would be told that it was in their interest to get rid of her." A series of suspicious events, including a fire at Mount Vernon, prompted Mrs. Washington to amend her husband's wishes. Although he wanted to provide for his wife via the use of slave labor, Martha Washington had her own slaves, dower slaves that were greater in number and completely capable of caring for her and the estate. So the second-time widow decided that it would be best to emancipate her late husband's slaves as soon as possible, and in December of 1800, she signed a deed of manumission to finalize her husband's wishes. On January 1st, 1801, George Washington's slaves were set free. While there must have been great jubilation among the president's slaves, the bond men and bond women belonging to the Daniel Park Custis estate were reminded of their own fate. The dower slaves at Mount Vernon, close to 200 of them at the time of Washington's death, were untouched by the president's will and could not be emancipated by George or Martha Washington. Indeed, upon her death, the slaves of the Custis estate were to be divided among Mrs. Washington's grandchildren. The newspaper reports and tributes to the life of the first president of the United States most certainly alerted the fugitive about the death of her master, but Mrs. Staines understood that this news was not a siren of freedom for her. She knew her lineage and understood that the president's death changed nothing about her own status. Although she had successfully escaped and lived some 500 miles away, Mrs. Staines was still a fugitive, and in some ways, a bit more vulnerable. With Washington gone, the heirs of the Park Custis estate were now in charge of the dower slaves, and that could include an attempt at kidnapping the fugitive and returning her to Virginia. Even if Mrs. Washington contemplated following her husband's example by emancipating the remaining slaves at Mount Vernon, she simply couldn't. The reality was that Martha Washington had inherited only one-third of her first husband's estate. The remaining two-thirds were to be passed down to her surviving grandchildren. The remaining slaves at Mount Vernon weren't legally hers to liberate, even if she had been so inclined. In any case, the dour slaves would not have long to ponder their fate, as Martha Washington struggled with illness and lived only a few years beyond her